particular lecture number, this would actually be four, wouldn't it? I believe in your notebooks, not three. Sometimes the orders get flip-flopped. Recapturing a forfeited ministry. If you're listening to the CD of this, this is lecture number four in track two. This is like drinking from a fire hydrant, this particular lecture. This has got a ton of material, and we're just going to hit some of the highlights. It's important for a couple of reasons. First of all, if you are interested in pursuing certification as a biblical counselor with the National Association of Authentic Counselors, this training goes towards that. And we therefore have certain requirements in terms of our training, our curriculum, we need to cover, and this is one of the topics. Why do we do counseling, and how did the counseling landscape get to be what it is today? We need to do some historical background, so we're going to touch base for that reason. But even if you say, I just want to learn how to help people better, well, I think it's important for us to spend some time thinking about how did counseling get in the shape that it's in today anyway? What we're doing in the first part of this 12-week counseling course is basically laying a foundation, and then we're going to build on it. So last week and this week and even next week we'll be dealing with foundational issues. So if you're thinking, boy, I was really hoping this was going to be a little more practical for my own life and helping other people, just hang in there with us. We've got to get some good foundation down so that it'll be able to hold the weight of the material that we'll be adding in later sessions when we talk in very practical terms about dealing with depression and marriage issues, communication, and so forth. Something else I need to say by way of an explanation is this particular material was originally prepared by Pastor Tim Pasma. Tim is a biblical counselor with NANC and a trainer of counselors. He's a friend of mine as well. He pastors in LaRue, Ohio. And that illustrates one of the benefits of NANC is the networking that it creates. None of us are sufficient. The Word of God is sufficient, and God has placed us as His servants in the local church in network and connection with other people that can be of help. And here's an example of that. I benefit greatly from some material that this brother has put together, and we'll be sharing that with you. I benefit regularly from interaction with other servants of Christ, particularly NANC certified folks that I can bounce questions off. What do you do when you face this kind of a situation? And that is another reason why I would encourage you to think about participation or pursuing certification with NANC. All right, let's begin now as we come to this subject. Many people wonder, what does the church have to do with counseling? Isn't that the jurisdiction of experts with their psychological insights? Most people today insist that the church has very little to do with helping people with personal problems. And I believe erroneously that many Christians concur with that view. As you see there, number two, pastors today are often actively discouraged from doing counseling. And I might add afraid of doing counseling for a lot of reasons. Legality, the whole just pressure. What do you know about helping people with deep personal problems? Is counseling a purely 20th, 21st century phenomenon? That's the question that we need to wrestle with. Has the church done counseling in the past? And when we go back into history, that's exactly what we find. Counseling is not outside the jurisdiction of the church, nor is it a new phenomenon in the church, because the Church of Christ has always been involved in, if you want to use the term, psychology, because psychology just means words about the soul. Psuche, or psyche, the soul. Logos, words about the soul. And that's something that the Scriptures surely address over and over. The church has always been involved in framing psychologies, if we want to use the term, and helping people. Now, it's not been called that historically. Number three, the title Cure of Souls is the one that the Puritans used to like to use. But whatever you call it, the church has historically been involved in the people helping business, taking God's truth, helping people work through their problems. I love that phrase, however, cure of souls. I think it communicates really what we're all about as we talk about biblical counseling. We're trying to equip you to be better at the cure of souls, coming alongside and ministering hope to the souls of men and women in need. So that has been something that's been in the past that the church was involved, but it changed. The cure of souls became the territory of individuals and institutions outside of and independent of the local church. For instance, just think of it this way. What typically happens when a parent is told by a teacher, your child is disruptive and may have ADHD? Or what typically happens when a person can't sleep at night and is full of anxiety and fear? Or what typically happens when a couple is having marriage trouble and can't get over past conflict? In each of those three scenarios, will they, A, call their pastor or another godly person in their congregation to seek help? Or will they, B, call a professional counselor or someone outside of the church for help? And typically what happens, and this was my experience as I shared last week for the first 5 or 6 years as a pastor here, is people would go outside of the church for help. And that's not at all a criticism of those who are providing help outside the church, because what the church has just unfortunately done for the last 100 years or so, I should say until the last 30 years or so, but there was that period of time where the church was punting the ball and saying, we can help you get to heaven, but when it comes to dealing with problems before then, we're not quite so sure. Now, the church acquiesced to those independent sources that I just mentioned, accepting from them the content and methodology for helping people. So even if in the past churches were doing people helping, they often were going outside the church and getting the way of thinking about problems and the methodology for dealing with those problems from the, quote, professionals in the world. And as I just indicated, in the last 3 decades, there's been a concerted effort to regain that ground, which we'll come to in just a moment and explain more about that. Now, how did the church forfeit that ground in the first place, and how can we regain it? The thrust of this lecture will be to give a broad historical outline of that forfeiture. If you want to go into more specifics on that, and it's an interesting study, I would encourage you to do so. I just want to, with a broad brushstrokes, give the big picture of how we got where we're at. Let's talk, first of all, about the church's practice of the cure of souls. And let's go all the way back in this time frame to the cure of souls in the New Testament age. Colossians 1:28, Paul said, whom we preach, warning every man. That's the term nuthateo, warning, counseling every man and teaching every man with all wisdom that we may present everyone complete in Christ. Ephesians 4:11-16 talks about how God has given gifts to His church, gifted individuals, apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastor, teachers, for the equipping of the saints for the work of the ministry. And the early church understood that. And we've already spent time, and we'll be spending a lot more time throughout our weeks together, showing how the New Testament itself emphasizes that we have been given by the Holy Spirit what we need to help people deal with their problems. The word nuthateo, this Greek verb, nuthateo, which is translated warning, admonishing, from the word nuthateo, from the word nous, for mind, and tithemi, which means to put into. So we're putting into the minds of people truth that God has given us in His Word. The New Testament emphasizes the importance of the doctrine of spiritual growth. The New Testament is all about people changing and how that happens through the person and work of Jesus Christ and by means of the Spirit who is at work, as we learned in the last hour. And the New Testament has a lot to say about the nature of shepherding and counseling and the environment of the local church for that. So the New Testament may not have a chapter that this is all about counseling, but it has the themes of that have to do with counseling woven throughout it. The church in the New Testament is the place where significant change occurs because it's the place where the word is ministered. So when you read your New Testament, you find out people's lives are being changed. You find out letters are being written by apostles to deal with real life issues like marriage and parenting and job challenges and personal struggles and anxiety and all of those kinds of things that you find in the epistles. Now as we move ahead in the historical time frame, we come to the cure of souls in the early and medieval church. Gregory the Great and his pastoral care, this is the late 6th century, described the priestly office as one of authority over souls and, quote, the government of souls is the state of the arts. He encourages the adaptation of admonitions to the needs of individuals. McNeil says about how Gregory said a pastor must deal with people differently depending on where they're at. And there's this quote. Do you have the quote in your handout there that says Gregory's Guide of Souls? Do you have that quote? Okay, I won't read through that, but you see there how he applies that. You've got John Merck's instruction for parish priests. And the bottom line is the church clearly had a sense of giving direction and guidance to the people. So the church was involved at this time in church history in the lives of its people, at least to some degree. Then you come to the Reformation in the 16th century through the 19th century, and we see that the reformers are at work recapturing the pastoral ministry, clearly involved themselves in the cure of souls. Of course, during the years leading up to the Reformation, the care of people had been removed from the Scriptures. The church was involved in people's lives, but the Scriptures basically had been put on the shelf because the average person didn't read and understand Latin. Whole other subject there. We don't have time for that. Pastor and theologian John Calvin says that the Scriptures indicate that pastors have both a public and private ministry. You can check out Calvin's Institutes. I believe you have the bio information there. Calvin, by the way, was a prolific letter writer, and you can read his letters. In fact, I remember hearing about, John Piper was talking about this in a sketch he did on Calvin, talking about letters that he would write, one in particular to a pastor who had lost his wife and how he ministered great hope to that pastor. Now, sometimes you folks think of Calvin as being just an academic theologian. He was a warm-hearted pastoral figure as well. He had a tremendous ministry to servants that were being martyred in France at the time, Calvin being in Switzerland. The Puritans of the mid-1500s exemplified the cure of souls, spending enormous amounts of time in private interviews, producing vast literature. Right? So you've got Baxter, for instance. Jonathan Edwards' works are classics, as he investigates the ministry of the working with the souls of men. And here's a tool that I have found to be just a very delightful little book. Ichabod Spencer. Now, how's that a name for a pastor? Pastor Ichabod. Spencer was a pastor in Brooklyn back in the mid-1800s, and he published this little, it's actually a two-volume. I just brought one of the volumes called A Pastor's Sketches. And he regularly visited his people and took time to write up the account of the nature of his visit. And it wasn't just going in talking about how good their pie tasted that day. I mean, he really ministered to the needs. You'll read, for instance, you'll go in and he'll talk about so-and-so was very overwhelmed with the loss of their spouse. And so I opened the Scriptures and began to probe to find out this is the thought they were struggling with. And this is the truth that I shared with them to help them work through that. Or someone else is struggling with, and all kinds of things. And you can read these sketches, these stories that he wrote up about how he ministered the Word of God to his people. Now, was he called a counselor? No, he was a pastor, and he had a heart for the cure of souls, the ministry of his people. That's the point we're trying to show, is that for now up until 1850 or so, godly shepherds and people in local churches were involved in helping people work through their problems. In the 19th century, the church entered an era where it gave up this ministry to others. We must admit that the church has always been influenced by surrounding psychologies, by surrounding ways of thinking about life and problems. Platonism and Stoicism in the early church, and I won't go through all of it. The church is constantly being bombarded by ways of thinking from the world that we must be prepared to respond to and defend ourselves against as we protect the Scriptures and minister the Scriptures. In other words, it's important to know what we believe, but it's important also to know how that's being attacked by the world, and often in subtle ways. And the church was not quite so aware of what was happening in the 19th century, and it began to give up this valuable ground we've been talking about. In this time period, the church was not merely influenced, but gave up this ministry of counseling to, and even began to learn from, these independent sources. All right, now let's develop that thought more carefully. Roman numeral 3, the church's abdication of the cure of souls. In other words, the church gives over the ministry of counseling. And how does that happen? Well, we need to talk about the rise of liberal theology for a moment. Liberal theology. Liberal theology has to do with those that deny the fundamentals of the faith, deny the inspiration and inerrancy of the Scriptures, for instance, deny the substitutionary work of Christ. Liberal theology. Liberal theology's basic organizing principle was that the theology of any age is an expression of the Christian experience of that age. Key word, experience. Because this is alive and well today. It's not called liberal theology anymore, but the presupposition is the same. This actually in the 19th century grew out of Schleiermacher, the German theologian. For liberal theology, the essence of religion is feeling. And certainly that is alive and well today. There's the emphasis on God's immanence as opposed to His transcendence. In other words, transcendence means God is great. You can't put Him in a little box. Immanence means He's like us. Well, salvation then is redefined in liberal theology. And again, I won't go into a lot more explanation of that, but liberal theology is affecting the way the church is thinking, and it's now affecting the way they viewed counseling. Number two, there was a great preoccupation with the subjective. For the liberals, the key to unlocking the mysteries of religion and reality is in ourselves. So man becomes central in liberal theology. You read the Scriptures, and theology is presented in the Scriptures. God is central. Romans 11:36, you could quote it. For from Him, and through Him, and to Him are all things. To Him be glory forever and ever. Paul says it's all about God. Liberal theology says, no, it's all about us. God exists for us. Salvation is about us and our needs. The psychology of religion movement became a force in the liberal church. This was primarily in the universities and seminaries, and was the study of religious experience, trying to explain people's religious experience. By the way, what happens in the universities and seminaries today eventually spills over into the local church tomorrow. That's overstating. It doesn't happen tomorrow. It probably happens in about 20 years. What happens in the universities today will show up in the churches in about 20 years. And you can understand why. The leaders that are being trained today will take those ideas with them, and they will teach them, and it will eventually show up in the lives of people in about two decades, maybe three decades. And that's exactly what was happening in this process. I'm going to pass by the rest of that just for the sake of time. Let's talk about letter B, the rise of psychiatry and psychology. Even at its genesis, psychological thought was varied and not monolithic. In other words, it's not correct just to talk about psychology. There are literally hundreds of psychological systems. So it would be a caricature to hold up psychology and say this is true of psychology across the board. There's all kinds of different psychological systems. We actually have in track one an examination of prevalent theories of psychology. We look at Freud and Rogers and Skinner as three main systems. So you might plug in or just jot down there, see track one lecture on prevalent theories if you want some more background on this part. But Freud's concept of man with an unconscious was different, for instance, from William James's view of man and so on. So there's difference, but psychotherapy, which had been growing in Europe since the mid-19th century, is now making its way into America at this time. What is typically called mental illnesses today fell under the jurisdiction of neurologists then, or at least prior to this. Most neurologists thought that these had an organic origin, but not everything seemed to respond to the physician's intervention. They started to make a distinction between organic and functional illnesses. Think about those two labels, organic and functional illnesses. An organic illness would be something that you could test under a microscope with blood. So a brain tumor, you could find it. It's called an organic problem because you can test it and find it as such. A functional illness would be, for instance, like what we call obsessive compulsive behavior, where there's behavioral issues that lead us to conclude that there's something going on medically. But it's not like you could pull out blood and see something there. And so they're starting to make this distinction at this point in the development of helping people between organic and functional. You've got the psychotherapeutic techniques that are starting to develop. And then in this process, then psychiatry and psychotherapy become part of the medical establishment. That's what I want you to see at this point. It was not a part of the medical establishment. It would have been what we call social science, but now it's becoming a part of the medical establishment, and then the medical terminology is being used to describe it. In post-World War I, America was gripped by psychological views of life. 100 psychologists served on the Surgeon General's staff in World War I, exposing 1,700,000 soldiers to psychological testing, and America was impressed. They start doing this testing, finding out things. You can read some of the background about that, I think, in your notes there, if you want to read more about that. But there's this fascination now with psychoanalysis. Number four, you've got the post-World War II American culture seemed to be greatly influenced by the psychology of self-realization. And out of that will come self-esteem and the whole self-esteem movement that every person has a right to feel good about himself. That this is the highest goal in education, to help young people feel good about themselves. Here's where you might plug in the lecture we do in track one as well on the self-esteem, the issue of self-image, self-esteem. And there's a interesting study that's documented in the textbook that we use in track one, How to Counsel Biblically, where it talks about comparing American students with the Korean students. If you were in track one, you'll remember that study because we talked about it. So you've got these studies of Korean students and American students, and they're asked a series of questions, and one of which is, I am good at math. And so you've got the Korean students, their assessment of themselves in terms of how good they are at math is very poor, whereas they're actually quite high in terms of their ability in math. The American students asked us, I am good at math. They saw themselves as being very good at math, when in fact their test scores weren't as good as the Koreans. In other words, we may not be doing very well, but we sure do feel good about ourselves. That's what we've come to in our country. And that's been happening now for about 100 years, this whole emphasis on self-realization, self-esteem, self-image. We were raised on that. We were all raised on that if we were in the public education system. And in other ways as well. The psychological cure of souls became the dominant force in liberal churches. Again, liberal churches, those that don't believe the fundamental truths of the faith. The Emmanuel Movement in 1905 was the first serious effort to transform the cure of souls in light of the new psychology and theology that had been developing in the liberal seminaries and that was filtering down into the churches. And there's some background about that. There's a statement there that I'll just back up to. Every pastor is a psychotherapist, they asserted, but the question is, would the cure of souls be guided by tradition or by the sciences? Tradition meaning by the Bible, by the church, or by the sciences, and by that they mean by psychology. These new sciences that are developing called psychology or psychotherapy. That experiment didn't last long, but it did provide a bridge for psychology to impact the cure of souls, and we'll come to that in a moment. Number two in this part of the outline, the Religious Education Association in 1903 began the effort to reorganize Sunday schools along the philosophy of John Dewey. And here's the whole educational philosophy that's now affecting Sunday schools and thus become another avenue of psychotherapy into the churches, whereas the purpose of education now becomes self-realization. So you start going to church not to learn about God and develop great thoughts about who God is and bring your life in conformity to that, but you go to Sunday school and you go to church to feel good about yourself, to get answers to help the life, the journey along life to be more comfortable for you. It's a subtle thing, and it's happened so gradually, and we're right in the middle of this, we might miss this. We don't go to church for us. I mean, that's a byproduct. We get wonderful. You read in the New Testament, church, life, everything's about God. But the shift has happened, and this is a part of it. In the seminaries, professors began to teach the subject of pastoral counseling along these lines, believing that it offered a means of personality adjustment. You've got influential thinkers like Carl Rogers coming along, and I think that's enough on that for this point. Now, clinical pastoral education begins to take place. In 1925, seminary students and pastors began training at Worcester State Hospital near Boston. Now, think about that. Starting to send individuals preparing for ministry in churches outside of the church context to a secular organization to get training so that they can now help people in churches. This is the shift that's now occurring in the liberal church. Pastoral students get professional training in the, quote, area of clinical pastoral education. The purpose was not to discover new methods of pastoral counsel, but to reshape the pastoral ministry. That's, again, in the liberal church. By the mid-20th century, the psychological cure of souls was firmly entrenched in the liberal churches. Now, most of us are not from a liberal church background, so I'm not going to spend any more time on that, but liberal church, those that deny, you know, the Bible, that deny the substitutionary work of Christ. But it didn't just stay in the liberal churches. The evangelical acceptance of the psychological cure of souls begins to happen as well. And I need to say at this point, as we mention some names of people and schools in the next part of this lecture, please realize by mentioning these names, we're not saying that they've never done anything good for the cause of Christ and His local church. And this is not meant to be an attack on a person. This is simply to do what we see Paul doing regularly in the New Testament, and that is, if someone teaches something publicly, they ought to be examined. And so you find Paul, for instance, saying in 1 Timothy 1:20, talking about Hymenaeus and Alexander. He calls them by name and he says to Timothy, you need to check these guys out. Alexander the coppersmith in 2 Timothy 4, you've got to watch out for what he's doing. Remember what Paul did with how he confronted Peter in the church at Galatia because of some things Peter had been doing. So you got even apostles being confronted and examined by other church leaders. The Bereans themselves in Acts 17 checked out what the Apostle Paul taught to make sure it was consistent with Scripture. And that's certainly what we would ask of you to do with us. Everything that's said from here, even as I pray tonight, check it to see if it's consistent with the Scripture. So it's in that spirit. We're going to talk about what some individuals have said publicly, written publicly, because when you go public with your teaching, it ought to be examined. And so that's the spirit in which we'll do this. We find the early acceptance of psychological views as follows. Let's just back up to that. The Christian Reformed Church began the first psychiatric services primarily for its constituents by founding the Christian Psychiatric, a psychopathetic hospital in Pine Rest Sanitarium, 1910. That's in Grand Rapids. I went to seminary in Grand Rapids, and that I think it's still that the Pine Rest was still there at that time. I'm assuming it still is today. You've got the formation of the Mennonite Mental Health Services, 1947. There were 1,500 Mennonite conscience objectors, and they then served in state mental hospitals as an alternative service during the war. So you've got that factor entering into it. This experience catalyzed in the formation of the MMHS. The new evangelicalism is taking place. In other words, there's a group of people still calling themselves Christians that believe that the Bible is the Word of God, believe that Christ is the only way to heaven, but they talk about the new or neo-evangelicalism, and they began to articulate a vision of re-engaging long-ignored cultural and social tasks, including problems in living. And so modern psychologies and the concept of mental illness come into view. In other words, you got this emphasis on we need to be relevant with what people are struggling with. So how are we going to be relevant? Well, let's find out what's happening out here and the people helping business around us in the secular realm. Let's benefit from that and let's start using that in the church. And so conservative Protestants began to acquire graduate education and licenses in the mental health professions. And you can understand why. The typical Christian colleges weren't providing help in the people helping area. So if you were interested in counseling or social work, you had to go to the secular schools to get the education and then the licensure that would allow you to function in the system. Even though conservative seminaries and pastors continued to neglect counseling, these professionals began to appear. Unlike the liberal churches, the psychologies gained access to evangelical churches through evangelical psychotherapists rather than through pastors. That's an important statement. In fact, I remember when I was in seminary back in the 1980s, I was also involved in student affairs work at the college while I was going through seminary, and so I was a resident director working with basically freshman college guys, and so we had a lot of training that we went through in the area of self-esteem and all kinds of things that you might imagine. But I also remember those in seminary at the time, if you were really burdened about wanting to help people, then you start. It was pretty popular to go off to a place that offered the Master of Arts in counseling, because it was just understood if you really wanted to help people, you were going to get that kind of training in seminary. You needed to go somewhere else to get that, because seminary helped you understand how to parse verbs and how to solve the prolegomena issues and all kinds of other things, give you tools and important tools. I don't discredit that at all, but when it came down to really helping people with marriage issues or whatever personal problems people were facing, you went somewhere else. You went and get the Master of Arts at some place that really was serious about that, as if the Bible didn't have anything to say about those issues. And that's what we're talking about in this point. The Christian Association for Psychological Studies was founded in 1952 among a small group of predominantly Christian Reformed psychologists and psychiatrists. And then a significant person by the name of Clyde Naramore comes along, becomes the first well-known evangelical psychologist in the late 1950s. I remember my Aunt Edie, loved Clyde Naramore. She'd get his books and she'd pass them along. Because, again, you can't fault this. The church was not giving answers to what people were struggling with. And here's someone that's starting to write about and talk about and on radio to teach about the issues that people are struggling with. He was an author, speaker, counseling practitioner, was both a psychologist and conservative Protestant. However, you examine the content of what he presented, and you find out that he was basically popularizing a Freudian understanding of man and his problems using evangelical terminology and morality, and thus gains acceptance in the churches because they recognize the Bible verses that he's using and the emphasis on morality that we love. But you examine at the core what he believes and you find out he believes what Freud, because he was trained in Freudian teaching, and Freud believed that man is basically good, that sin is not sin, it's a sickness, that there's this internal struggle between the id, ego, and superego that's the cause of people's problems, and so what they need is a professional that can do the analysis necessary to straighten out this internal conflict between the id, the ego, and the superego. His Naramore Christian Foundation was a vehicle for publishing materials, training pastors and other Christian workers, offering counseling services. And then you've got the schools that are being established at this time. Fuller Theological Seminary starts its graduate school of psychology in 1965. Its mandate was, quote, to integrate the evangelical understanding of biblical doctrine with scientific and applied aspects of psychology to reconceptualize psychology in such a way as to be consistent with the tenets of an Orthodox Protestant cosmology and anthropology. A huge statement there, but the bottom line is, okay, the Bible isn't really sufficient to address the needs of modern man, so we need to take the fruit of the studies of modern anthropologists, the people who study and do work with man, take the fruit of that and basically take the system of thoughts that are being developed, system of thought developed by professional psychologists, and take Bible verses and wed that in, and then we'll call that Christian counseling. Its intention was to produce mental health professionals. You've got Trinity Evangelical School hiring Gary Hollins as Collins, a professor of pastoral psychology, 1969, Trinity, there in Deerfield, Illinois. You've got the Rosemead Graduate School of Professional Psychology, 1970. By the mid-1970s, the psychological cure of souls found acceptance in evangelical circles. In fact, many, if not the majority of, quote, Christian colleges and seminaries to this day would offer that type of integrational training in their counseling teaching. In other words, integration, when we use that term, we're saying to take the Bible and psychology, mix them together. That's integrationalists or integration. And that's typically what's taught in most Christian colleges and seminaries to this day, would be integration when it comes to counseling. It's important to note that before the 1950s, psychological counseling in churches was found only in churches of liberal theology. That is certainly not the case to this day in evangelical churches. Now, that's kind of how we got where we are. Let's talk now about what's been happening in the area of regaining the counseling ground. You're reading the watershed text in this class by Dr. J. Adams, Competent to Counsel, 1970. This particular book, written by J. Adams, who at the time was a professor of practical theology at Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia, begins to call the church back to the Scriptures, that God has given us sufficient answers for dealing with the problems of life. There's a wonderful story behind how that all came about, and you can check that out. I think it's in the prelude of that book, if you didn't read that. You've also got not only J. Adams with that book, but you've got the founding of the Christian Counseling and Education Foundation, or CCEF, as we'll refer to it. You're reading some of the little pamphlets that are published by CCEF. That's established in 1968. David Pallison today would be associated with this group. Robert Jones, some of you remember Robert's taught here before, used to pastor in West Virginia, would have been involved in, he's written some things that have been published by CCEF. And they, again, are, this group is raised up with the burden to get folks trained in the Scriptures to help people. Then you've got the founding of Faith Baptist Counseling Ministry, a ministry of faith Baptist Church in Lafayette, Indiana, that we'll refer to regularly. 1977. Pastor Bill Good at the time, the present pastor of the church is Steve Viers. They've kind of just led the way in this whole matter of getting counseling back into the church and also counseling training into the church. They offer their one-week training that I encourage you to consider at some point. The first week of February, they have multiple tracks of biblical counseling training that goes on there. It's always the first week in February, and you'll have, I don't know, last year, and they must have had 1,200 or more folks in that, I think, six tracks last year. But Faith Baptist Biblical Counseling Ministry there in Lafayette, wonderful provision and tool for the church. John Broger founds the Biblical Counseling Foundation, 1977. And then the National Association of Authentic Counselors was established in 1976. Today, NAC has, I think it's over 600 certified biblical counselors. And we'll be talking more with you about that organization and what's involved in pursuing certification with them as we go through the weeks together. But that organization, also referred to as NAC, becomes very significant in the biblical counseling landscape. And so what we see happening is this emphasis on getting counseling back into the church. And not just counseling back into the church, but individuals trained in the scriptures to help people in the local church. And to do so, we must become case-wise when it comes to people. Psychological cure of souls became prominent in liberal circles because the Bible-believing churches neglected people, while the liberals observed people and sought to help them. I love this statement. The liberals lost the book, but fundamentalists lost the people. That is critical to see. Liberals lost the book, but the fundamentalists lost the people. And thankfully, what's happening in the last couple of decades is that those of us who are committed to the fundamentals of the faith and committed to the Scriptures as being God's precious Word from beginning to end are also realizing that God's given us answers for the problems of life, hence the title of this course, Biblical Answers for the Problems of Life. We must develop a systematic understanding of people and their problems. So we need to be case-wise when it comes to people in the regaining of counseling in the church, but we also need to develop a systematic understanding of people and their problems, because what you don't systematize, you lose. We touched on that last time when we did the theological pyramid, and you might plug in that thought there. Only a knowledge system that can define problems and tasks and defend them will gain jurisdiction. Until J. Adams came along, there was no orthodox, systematic understanding of people and their problems since Ichabod Spencer's publication that I mentioned in 1850. J. Adams has been a wonderful resource in his writing. He's written, he's way past the 100 book mark by now. We'll actually be having a book table here in a few weeks with materials, many of J. Adams' books and others that will be available for your purchase if you want to continue to build your library in the area of biblical counseling. And that'll be coming up here, as I mentioned, in a few weeks. Well, as we conclude this session, regaining counseling for the church has just begun. There is so much work that's yet to be done in this area. A wonderful resource for you would be to check out NANC's website, nanc.org, and you can see there's continual training going on provided by NANC all around the country. I'm very thankful to have a part in that. We'll be traveling to Houston next month and Philadelphia in a couple of months for what NANC used to call their on-the-road training. Now they call it Counseling and Discipleship Training, CDC. And basically what that is, and I mention that because as you have folks you know around the country, not everyone can participate in a 12-week course like you're doing on Monday evenings, or Faith Baptist Lafayette offers theirs during the days on Mondays for 11 weeks. Not everybody can do that. So here's another alternative to the training. And what NANC offers is a Friday evening, all-day Saturday format for once a month for 3 months to get basically what you're getting here in this track too. They offer that Friday evening, Saturday, once a month for 3 months. And then they have two tracks in that, so you could come back the second year and do the training in that format. The training currently is being offered, as I mentioned, in those locations, Houston, Philadelphia. There's going to be a new one starting in St. Louis in September. There's one out on the West Coast up in the Seattle area. And there's at least one or two others that I'm drawing a blank. They had one up in the Boston area, but I think they're done with that one. But you can check on their website and see the different locations for that training. So it's this matter of counseling training is actually just really hitting, not even its peak probably, it's just the interest for it is all over the country, and it's really growing in terms of the momentum. We must be convinced, letter B, that this is a legitimate area of ministry and seek to understand the problems of living in a systematic, biblical way. I think that says well what the training did for me. As I went through the biblical counseling training at Clear Creek Chapel back in 94, 95, and then I went out to Faith in Lafayette for a year as well. What it did for me was that I came back with a systematic, biblical way of thinking about the problems of life. I mean, I was convinced theoretically that I'm sure there's got to be answers in there somewhere, but the training helps you to begin to just identify, okay, what are the problems that people are struggling with and where do we find help for those particular problems? And I hope that that's the sense that you'll come away from track two with after being in with us for the 12 weeks, is that you have a systematic, biblical way of understanding problems for your own life and then helping other people. All right. Let's take a 10-minute break. Then we'll come back together. Tonight we're going to stay together here. Track three will be staying over in the other room to do some things. We're going to be talking about case studies here. Please don't get scared and run out now. I want you to come back. This the third hour, even if you're not prepared, come for the third hour tonight because we're going to begin to work through the two case studies that were assigned for tonight and discuss those together. That's really where we move from theory to practice when we talk about situations. And so anyway, case studies are coming up in the next hour.